Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello and welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Teresa, and today we've actually got a full house. So I'm here with Heather.
Hi.
Pat.
Hello.
Stephanie.
Hello.
Linda.
Hi.
And Nicola.
Morning.
Hooray. Okay, this week we're announcing our new writing competition. Pat will be sharing a work in progress. Then we're going to have a little chat about our writing lives and what we've been up to. We've got a brilliant interview with Liz Harris about plotting. And Stephanie and Chris Heath will be telling us what's on their bedside table. But first, Heather is going to ask us to
name the novel.
It was 7 minutes after midnight.
That's the first clue.
It was 7 minutes.
Already?
Oh, is it?
It rings a bell, actually.
Oh, hang on, I'm writing something down. It's okay. A guess.
I have my pen poised to write something down.
Okay. So do I, but it's not writing.
Okay.
The dog was lying on the grass in the middle of the lawn in yes. front of Mrs. Shear's house.
Yeah, I know what it is.
Got it.
I know what it is.
First guess was wrong, but I think I know what it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Its eyes were closed. It looked as if it was running on its side, the way dogs do when they think they are chasing a cat in their dream. But the dog was not running or asleep. The dog was dead.
Ooh. Yeah.
I know.
You got it first, didn't
I think
you?
Even I've got this one.
Go on, Pat.
The curious incident of the dog in the night.
Yeah.
I got that. But I got it on the second clue.
I got it on the second clue.
I get scores.
Scores on the doors.
Yeah, very good.
Nice choice because it's destined to become a classic. I think so.
Who was it by?
It's by Mark Haddon.
That's right, Mark Haddon.
It was the author's first book written intentionally for adult audience. And the book won the Whitbread Book of the Year Award in 2003. And it's now a successful stage production.
Mm-hmm. Is it?
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
That was what was on stage when the ceiling collapsed. Do you remember there was a very serious ceiling collapse in a theatre in London a couple of years ago? And that was the show that was playing.
Oh, right. It was a curious incident.
And it wasn't playing then.
I've seen the stage production and it was absolutely fantastic.
Oh, well, so
really, really good. Yeah. The National Theatre, it was really good.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you, Heather.
Good one.
Now, Pat is going to read us something from her work in progress, a little bit more about Mariana and Mark, I think, and then we'll give her some feedback.
Okay, it's after Peter's stroke. He's still in hospital and Mark has taken on the job of caring for, looking after Mariana. He escorts her to the hospital and they're becoming closer and closer. And this is just a short extract where she talks about meeting Mariana, reminisces about meeting Peter. Mark would escort her home and they would have supper together. Mariana would have prepared something before they left for the hospital and Mark would serve it when they returned. She would question Mark about Peter's progress. Did he think he looked better than yesterday? Did he seem to have more movement in his hand? Was there more colour in his face? At first, he didn't know what to say. But gradually, he realised that she just needed some reassurance, that all he needed to do was to agree with her and to listen, to let her talk. Often, she would talk about their life together, telling him how they'd met. She explained about the problems in Hungary in the 1950s that had resulted in them both finding themselves in London and how very different their backgrounds were. My family were wealthy because my father was a successful businessman. We had a good life in Hungary, but he knew that we must leave while we could. At first I was sad to lose my friends and I missed my life in Budapest. We had such parties, such glamour. Her eyes sparkled at the memory. London seemed so grey. But soon I made friends and I discovered the theatre. Ah, I fell in love with the theatre. I wanted to become an actress. My father was horrified, but I told him, in England it is very respectable. Some actors even become lords and ladies. This impressed him. I did not tell him that the chorus work that I wanted to audition for would not make me a lady. But it was the only work I could do that would allow me to enter that world. When I met Peter, I thought he was so different from the other people I knew, from my friends. He was so serious. He had had to leave Hungary because of politics. He was a student and was involved in the unrest. It became dangerous for him to stay. I think I saw him as some romantic hero. Her face softened as she remembered the earnest young man who'd seemed always to be cold, his scarf wrapped around his throat and tucked into the too small jacket, his shoulders hunched, his hands always thrust into his pockets. He was a PhD student when they met, an expert in Eastern European history and politics. They had nothing in common apart from their nationality. But she would meet him for coffee or walk through obscure parts of London, or even when the weather allowed it, just sit in one of the parks talking, because he had no money for the shows or the clubs or the restaurants that other admirers took her to. Her friends teased her about her poor student, and she laughed with them. But when he was offered a lectureship at the University of Manchester, she realised she must go with him. I knew I could not lose him, she said. I loved him.
Mm. Very good.
Very good.
Yeah.
I was happy to see the part about how she prepared food before they left and then Mark served it to her when they came home. And I thought, what a wonderful way she's including Mark and how wonderfully he is adapting to her. He was so shy in the beginning. Mm.
Yeah, and she is that kind of a warm, open person, as we saw in the earlier passages, that, you know, she has this relationship without fear and anxiety. And, I mean, I don't know what's happened in between about the newspaper article, but, you know, whatever, she trusts him, which is delightful.
And keeping him going, keeping her going, isn't it? Looking for him, otherwise she'd be all on her own worrying about Peter and have nothing else to do.
Yeah, and nobody to travel to the hospital with. Mm. Yeah,
and I love that theme of kind of exile.
Yeah,
from Hungary and that kind of strange loss, strange sadness.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out to be good in the end.
Yeah,
but you can kind of feel she was exiled from her own country.
Mm. Yeah,
and that probably makes her relationship with Peter all the more. You know, you can understand how they got together because he was an expert in Eastern European history and politics.
Yeah, and it's a shared cultural experience.
Yeah.
You know, it's those things that we don't notice when we're talking with friends, for example, maybe about the music from the 1970s or whatever, that we have that shared culture. Mm. We don't think of it, we're not conscious of it. Mm. But when you're in a foreign place and you meet somebody from your home place, you do have that connection.
Yeah, you do.
Do you think it needs a sentence about the problems in Hungary in the 1950s? It depends on the reader, doesn't it? You know, but certainly, I mean, I have this. Was it 1956 when the Russians
revolution.
Sent the tanks in? But that's all I know, basically, you know, and I know a lot of, just slightly before I was born, but I know people who were in the British Communist Party left, a lot of people left the Communist Party as a result of this crushing of a rebellion in Hungary, but that's not everybody even has that much awareness of it.
I didn't know whether it needed a bit more or whether just to reference the fact that there were problems in Hungary.
The Russian tanks rolling in, that you just need a sentence like that, really, and it sums it up.
I don't know. What do you think, Stephanie?
I just liked the touch on it.
Okay.
I was more interested in the feeling of exile than actually what had happened in the 1950s.
So,
but it's the kind of thing that might prompt you to go and Google Hungary in the 1950s, and if it's up to people. The one thing I did notice was that there was a slight shift in point of view. You knew what I was going to say. In the second paragraph, we've got, she would question Mark about Peter's progress.
Mm-hmm.
And then at first he didn't know what to say, which is Mark. And then in the next paragraph we go back to Marianne, Mariana, so I think perhaps that needs tightening up a bit.
Yeah, I put something about the point of view seems to be Mark as a listener, but I wasn't sure, and wondered whether we need more of his reaction to emphasise that, mm-hmm. or do we just...
You're right, actually, yeah, but I'd read the whole thing as if it was Marianna's point of view, yeah. but that part confused me, because
I got slightly confused about whether Mark went to the hospital or whether they both went to the hospital. I realised that they did both go to the hospital, mm. but just at first, and I don't know whether that's the shift that made me confused.
Yeah.
You mean because Mark would escort her home, which would imply that he was there to drive her home, but you don't know whether he actually visited
and
or
then
not.
When you get the questioning, you know, did he think he looked better than yesterday? Yes. Then you think, actually, did he go and she didn't?
Yes.
So it's a little bit unclear.
I have a question about in paragraph 4, the beginning. My family were wealthy. Mm. Now, I know that a family consists of more than one person.
Mm.
However, a family is one unit.
Yeah.
And so when I read my family were wealthy, it sounded strange to me.
Mm.
And so while I guess either one could work if you're thinking of family as more than one, but I think of family as one.
Mm-hmm.
And does it mean in the past as well? That's what I took it to mean because, in the past.
Yeah, I took it to mean my family were wealthy. We had a good life in Hungary.
But
then all the troubles came.
I think what Linda was saying is my family was wealthy.
It's the grammar, isn't it?
Oh, I beg your pardon.
I think you can use it as, you know, a singular family or my family, meaning the members of my family. Mm. So
I think we do. Technically, I think you're right. I think it's a singular noun. Yeah. So, yes, it should be was.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of those slightly grey areas,
it's one of those, sometimes if you're too correct, it draws attention to itself, whereas actually you don't really want that word.
And it almost sounds wrong, even though it's technically right.
That caught me up when I was reading my family were. And
That may be because it's more colloquial in English to say my family were.
Or maybe you're thinking it's because my family weren't wealthy.
Certainly wasn't. I love the sentence. Her face softened as she thought of him, and he was always cold. And you know, hunched. You didn't actually say it. You showed, not told.
Well, that's right. I was going to pick up on that because you didn't actually need to say he had always seemed cold. You could have just said the earnest young man who always had his scarf wrapped around his throat and tucked into the too small jacket, his shoulders hunched, his hands always thrust into his pocket.
That does show he's cold, doesn't it?
Mm. Yeah. So you didn't really need to say the young man who had seemed always to be cold. Okay. You could have just left that out.
I obviously didn't even hear that because all I heard was the hunched shoulders and the scarf.
It was a beautiful show, so you didn't need to tell us he was cold. Mm-hmm.
But her face,
we'll talk about show, not tell another day.
Yeah, we can maybe use that example at a later date when we talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you for that.
Okay.
Welcome.
Well, I thought it was lovely, and I'm happy to see.
Yeah, I've put a touching piece which tells us a lot about this couple.
Yeah,
And it's also revealing about her relationship with Mark. So I thought it was very good.
It's a reactive chapter rather than
get you.
Someone's been reading
to
her.
Yes, I have. Who says? Well, I didn't know what point of view was when I was writing.
Yeah, she's left us behind.
Oh,
now,
yeah,
hasn't she?
I know.
She's moved on. Okay.
I did wonder about this. If Peter is conscious or not, because I thought if he is, he would be able to tell Marianne to watch out or something because of what he knows, but she doesn't.
Right.
I don't know, but that was interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps
mm-hmm.
that's why Mark's going to the hospital with her, to make sure he doesn't come around and tell her something while he's there.
So I don't think Mark is devious.
The jury's still out.
Remains to be seen, doesn't it? Now we're going to have a bit of a catch-up. So, Stephanie, what's been happening in your writing life the past few weeks?
Well, as you lot got my arm at my back and gave me a deadline, a drop-dead date for finishing the edit of my first draft, and I promised you, because you'd got my arm behind me, I have been focused on that. But here's a confession. I've also devoted some time to entering some writing competitions.
Great.
And that's proved quite time consuming because every competition wants a different length submission, a different format submission, a different synopsis style or length of synopsis. I've found really that that's interfered with my writing time.
Yeah.
So I am a bit behind.
Not to mention organising this podcast. You do a lot of that.
Well, okay. Yeah. So I'm looking for a bit of an extension to my deadline.
Okay, we'll let you off. We'll let you off.
Thank
you.
I'm not going to let her off because to me, all of this smacks of procrastination. It is because you find ways not to finish that. And I've noticed this throughout. We had to force you to say you would. And now you're saying, oh, I need an extension because I can't get to it. That's, as far as I'm concerned,
oh, Linda,
somebody has to do it because Stephanie, you have reason to get that finished. And why on earth you keep postponing it, I cannot understand, unless you're just so afraid.
That they'll say no.
Yeah,
maybe. There's something in that.
I hear what you're saying, and there are three words that are occurring to me. Pot, kettle and black. I know you're not as far ahead as Steph, but there is the argument that these competitions are a great way to showcase your work and that they are time-bound and some of the big ones that Steph's been entering have, if she doesn't do it now, she won't be able to do it till next year. So that's quite a thing, isn't it?
Thank you, Nicola.
I'm just trying to be impartial.
Just going back to emphasise what Steph was saying about competitions, because some people think it doesn't matter to read the brief. You just send in what you think and, you know, and not to do the format correctly and not to put a synopsis in. It's a big mistake because when they get thousands and thousands of entries, they're going to chuck away, first of all, the ones that don't fit the brief.
Yeah.
So it's really important to do it right. Yeah. And it does take time because I did this with a play a few years ago. I submitted it to every possible theatre that was asking for plays or every possible competition that it fitted. As you say, they're all different. Some want the whole thing. Some want 10 pages. Some want a biog. So
it also creates a burning bridge because if you're longlisted or shortlisted in some of these competitions, they'll come back to you and say, right, now we want the full manuscript.
Yeah.
So now I've entered them all, I've got to get the damn manuscript properly edited.
Can I just ask, do you save the different draft of the synopsis separately, for example, so you wouldn't have to, if you entered something else now, you'd be able to go back to it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But, plus, it must also, in doing that, it does get you to know your work more thoroughly.
That's a good
point.
Yes.
You look at it from different angles. And actually, that can be helpful, I think, in seeing where you need to go and so on.
I think when you do your edit. You are all making excuses for her. And let me tell you, she has someone waiting for this already who has said, let me see it when you've finished the first draft. And that woman is going to forget who she is by the time she gets it in if she continues to procrastinate. And I don't care how useful it is to enter these contests. As Teresa said, she wouldn't have time to do it until next year. That's fine, do it next year. You have this job first, prioritize.
Okay, Linda. Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
That's you told me.
I've never heard you be so definite.
It matters to me a great deal because she has a wonderful novel and I want to see her follow through.
Yeah.
And I also know that she's always a little hesitant about reading, and I think, don't worry, it's wonderful. You don't know that, we do.
Tough love.
And you have someone waiting to see it. And I think that you should first tackle that, prioritize, Steph.
Yeah, okay.
So, Linda, on that note, what have you been up to?
Well, I have been up to rewriting a lot.
Well, that sounds like procrastination.
Just to me, rewriting classic delay.
I write, part of it, I think, is the format we're using for this podcast because we have a limited number of words we can read, and I tend to write longer scenes. So I need to go back through and try to shorten her. That's what I've been doing.
Yeah.
And also, as everybody here knows, whenever you go back to look at what you've done, you see things that need improvement. Mm-hmm. And you're right. That's a delaying tactic. And what I always tell other people is, don't do that. Keep writing all the way through. You go back and edit
it
later.
It's interesting because when we talked to Liz Harris, she talked about this, and I always feel guilty that I should be pushing on through and pushing on through. Obviously, she is a more organised person, but she always reads what she did the day before. So you'll hear that in the interview.
Oh, okay.
So it's interesting, and it made me think, oh, well, that's okay then. But then all I ever do is go backwards, so that's not so okay. But anyway,
I know. Yeah. So I've been naughty in that regard.
Okay.
So none of us perfect then.
No. But I have found that I'm far more productive now this year using Heather's method. Heather writes every Tuesday, and I chose the day Monday is. And I've gone through my calendar and written in big letters every Monday, Linda writes. So there's no room to put anything else.
Yeah, good, good. Because we're all waiting for the finished Mary Magdalene novels. We love that girl. We love that girl. Yeah. And we want to read it.
A couple of listeners have told me that they're waiting for the Audible with reading it.
Yes.
They really liked
the Audible. Yes, it has to be read by Linda. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Thank you.
Nicola?
Well.
Written a trilogy recently?
Well, I've had a major crisis of confidence. Yeah, I did. I went through a phase where I just thought, this is too hard. I don't know if I want to spend my spare time, what little there is of it, doing this, because I could just be lying on a sunbed reading other people, you know, so many marvellous books I haven't read out there.
Yeah.
Do I really want to do this? And then when it came to submitting some work in progress for this podcast, I thought, I just wrote 1,000 words and it felt fantastic.
It's funny,
so,
isn't it?
Yeah, so I've figured out now that if I just write 1,000 words every time we have a podcast episode, then I'm going to have a novel of 80,000 words in about 60 episodes' time.
Well, that's great, isn't it? It's great. I mean, we're already on episode 22. I mean, who would have thought that?
No, it did feel so good to actually do it. And I have 2 days blocked out. I have Monday afternoons and Friday afternoons, and everything else just encroaches on it. So I think I'm going to have to block a whole day, because otherwise it tends to be my catch-up time for the day, you know, proper job work I haven't done. So.
Yeah.
So I think one day at least. I mean, if I even wrote,
well,
you know, if
don't,
I even wrote
don't make it Tuesday if you want Roy to come round and make lunch and bring you
right. Hire him out as the writer's support. The writer's quasi
husband. Why don't you just get everybody round to your place on a Tuesday and Roy could cook for all of us?
Now you're talking. Yeah.
But, you know, even if I just wrote 5,000 words a week, which is theoretically possible because it didn't take me that long to write 1,000. That would get me there, quite quickly.
That's the way to look at it, because writing a novel is immense.
It's
a massive task. Mm. And so if you can look at it in terms of a chapter, 1,000 words, even 500 words, for me is an achievement as the least prolific writer ever.
Yeah.
But you know,
who was it that said they like to percolate their work first? Was it you?
Well,
you
I tend to think about things a lot before I write them down.
I think because I'm always thinking about the scenes. I've got a few of the scenes in my mind that need to happen. So when I sat down and wrote one of those scenes, because I had been percolating it came out quite easily. So
that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mentioned on a previous podcast, I think, how I found that going to sleep was something on my mind, an unsolved problem. Mm. And I wake up and there was a solution. Mm. So I try now when I go to bed at night to have something on my mind that I want to finish.
That's very interesting, isn't it?
It's
the cryptic
working.
Crossword thing again, you'll hear in the Liz Harris interview. It's interesting. Heather, what have you been up to?
Well, for 5 months, absolutely nothing.
You've been recuperating.
Everything went. I had the concentration span of a goldfish, and I didn't even try and write. Mm. And then suddenly I was on the train coming back and I wrote a poem. And now I've got my Tuesdays back where I literally just sit in my dressing gown and write. I don't particularly plan what I'm going to write, and I don't read what I've written. I use the Stephen King suggestion of writing, and I can write 5,000-6,000 words, and I don't go back to it straight away. I wait to go back to it.
Mm-hmm. And when you go back to it, Heather, do those 5,000 words become fewer?
No.
the beginning.
I know that the theory is that there's supposed to be fewer, but I tend to add things in because I find I've missed things out the first time. Okay. Because
you're not thinking too hard about it. No, and
the writing that I'm doing is based on the Safeguarding Vulnerable Adults work I did when I was working.
Yeah.
And some of it is just things that are in my head and I need to get off my chest and get out there.
Yeah.
And some of that is just cathartic for me.
Yes.
So I then find I've missed chunks out or it's not particularly made sense. Mm-hmm. But I'm back on it.
But
good for you.
So if I'm the least prolific, I think Heather's the most prolific.
Probably. And are you still working on the two things, Heather? You've still got the street, the occupants of the street, and then the travel to journal.
Yes.
The road trip.
I've just got photographs to put in the journal. The journal's finished.
Wow.
I've just got some photographs to add in, and I'm not technically able to do that. The other piece of work is this short story is all in the same street.
Yeah, very good.
And I'm trying not to kill off too many people.
Well, I was thinking when I read your work in progress, I was thinking, you know, a timeline of the street would be really helpful for you, wouldn't it?
What I've done, picked up a few things, obviously from other people, is I've written a character. Portrait, if you like, of each of the characters, mm-hmm. and I've put their ages so that hopefully things are right. And I'm trying to bring in other characters into each story so that there's a thread going through.
There was an Asian lady who pops up in somebody else's story as a name.
A bit like
I mean, have you seen the Jimmy McGovern dramas, The Street? It's a similar idea to that, isn't it?
I'm trying not to overcomplicate it because then I'll just get tied up and lost. Mm-hmm. So
just leave that.
I might go back to that.
I think it's wonderful that you're dealing with safeguarding vulnerable seniors.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and that comes from your occupation. Your,
I thought you were going to say that comes from my heart.
But you're not vulnerable or senior.
I am senior, not vulnerable.
No, you're not at all. Not the way you tore a strip off. No, I was going to say, I like the idea that neighbours pop up in the stories, but I don't think they need to be time connected. It's a collection of stories, and they can. I don't think one might happen at Christmas, for example. And,
I wasn't suggesting they go in order. I was just thinking that for Heather's own knowledge, she's got this street that goes from X time to X time, perhaps, and then she could just put on a spreadsheet, which story fits where and how old the characters are and things.
I just don't want to make a huge mistake by making somebody 10 years older
because the detail police will pick up on it.
Yes.
Anyway, well done, Heather. Pat, you've also been quite busy in your non-writing life. So have you been getting up to much writing?
No. For the last month, my writing life has just been completely hijacked by a house move.
Yeah.
So my life's consisted of wrapping and packing. And then unwrapping and unpacking.
And being caught in blizzards in between.
Blizzards.
The beast from the east.
Conversations with carpet fitters, joiners, removals men. And in fact, the only things I've written in the past month are to-do lists.
Checks.
Lots of to-do lists because you look at them and you think, oh, God, I'll start all that all over again all gone to pot. So I did actually consider writing a magazine feature, sort of advice on moving house, but it only consisted of one word, don't.
Well, that's rude. I thought it might have been something rude.
No. But I have decided that having a complete break can give you a whole new perspective. So it might be that when I come back to the project fully, I'll get back to work with a fresh iron, renewed vigour.
Great.
Fingers crossed. Yeah. Tightly.
I was thinking, as you were saying that you might have a lovely little short story, perhaps, with all the to-do lists. I think it would be interesting to go back and see how many times you've written things from one to another so you could have a clean page.
And also, I think the magazine article would work because you could start out as this this sort of supposed organised expert who's going to tell you how to move house, and then it all goes horribly wrong, and it would be
you could do a
comic story.
A Bridget Jones diary chronicling how much wine you drank every night.
I think it probably needs a little distance. It's all too raw.
Yeah, yeah. You're still suffering the trauma, so
I am.
You're not ready to deal with it yet. I get that.
So what have you been up to then?
Well, since you asked, Stephanie, I've been doing something a bit different. I've been doing some non-fiction writing, not for the first time. As you know, I wrote a little travel piece around New Year. But my Greek teacher, Sophia, told me that there was a story written by Jules Verne that was set in the Mani, the area of Greece that I know and love so well. And so I got hold of this story and I recognised immediately the location from his description. And I thought, well, he must have been here. And I looked it up. So he came in the 1860s. He was a sailor. The story, The Archipelago on Fire, was published in 1884, I think, but it's set in 1827. But it was based, definitely, he you know, on his actual experience. So my idea, this sort of combined with another idea of writing about walking in Greece. So I've written a first draft, actually a second draft now, of an article which I'm calling In the Footsteps of Jules Verne, which is about walking a particular route in Greece. And I'm quite happy to have written 1,100 words. For me, that's great, because I do so little, so rarely. So I'm quite pleased with that. So I'm still working on it, and I'm hoping you guys will maybe have time to critique it when we finish recording for this week. And my intention is hopefully to place that in a nature writing magazine or something like that. So, yeah, but as far as the novel, nothing happening there at the moment. Although I have to say, after speaking to Liz Harris, I feel reinvigorated and inspired. That'll wear off very quickly.
One of these days, I think we need to talk about your writing habits, because you seem, I think you're involved in a lot of activities that I know you have many different associations with, charity and walks and etc. But it seems to me that with all of that, you are not giving priority to the writing. Heather and I have knocked it. We got Mondays and Tuesdays covered. But I think it was the little book I have, The Art of War, or The War of Art, that's one. Remember how he says you have to make it first of all in everything, and how if you're not careful, you know, you'll pick up the phone when it rings and talk to somebody and you're putting it off, et cetera. And he said, a true writer wouldn't pick up the phone.
Yeah. And I accept what you're saying, and maybe I'm not a true writer in those terms. I'm a dilettante or whatever, but yeah, I am disorganized. I do flit from one thing to another. It's absolutely true.
Linda's been very stern
today.
She is.
She's
taken a stern pill.
She's taken
she
a school mom pill.
I know. I have. I came here with the intent of
licking us all into shape,
straightening everyone out. Well, I'm sorry, but there is nothing that says a hypocrite can't also be a good friend.
Well, yeah, I resemble that remark. So that's, we'll go with that. Okay, well done. Okay, thanks everybody. Now we're going to hear an interview that Stephanie and I did with Liz Harris the other day. We talked to her about plotting. We're delighted to be talking to Liz Harris today, author of contemporary and historical fiction, including The Road Back, A Bargain Struck, Evie Undercover, The Art of Deception, and The Lost Girl. Hello, Liz.
Right. Hello, Teresa and Stephanie. Thank you so much for inviting me to talk to you today.
The first thing I'd like to ask you is it really necessary to plot a novel?
Well, I would say in a single word, yes. I can't imagine what the novel would be like if you didn't plot it. But I think possibly novels that would fall into the genre of literary novels are more character-led than plot-led. So you could say in that case, if you are writing a novel that is very character-led, then you could get away with not having much of a plot. I think you would need some thread of story, some thread of plot, though, to hold your characters together. So it's hard to imagine a book which has absolutely no plot at all. Mm. People ask you, what's your book about? And if you say, well, there's Joe and he's an eccentric, and there's Johnny and he's an eccentric, etc., etc., and you give the characterization, I don't think you would encourage many people to pick that book up. But if you can give a line of what the book's actually about, then you're part of the way towards selling it.
And do you use a particular method of plotting or a particular structure?
I know people do use things like Scrivener, and they follow charts, and they have ways of organising it, of dividing it. I don't do that because I write mainly historical, although The Art of Deception and Evie Undercover are contemporary, set in Umbria, as I visit Umbria a lot. I love it. Generally, I start with the history. I start with the research, and I might start that before I even have a clear idea of storyline. For example, when I wrote The Road Back, it fell in my lap quite by chance. This was the first book I had published, although I had written others beforehand. Quite by chance, I came upon the fact that my late uncle had compiled an album when he had visited Ladakh in the 1940s, and he had photographs and details about his trip. It was very rare, I understood from my cousin, his daughter, for foreigners to be allowed into Ladakh. So I was very curious to read the album, which is now in England in the British Library on Euston Road in the Indian Room. But I had it for 2 weeks before I handed it over to the British Library. Mm-hmm. Fell in love with Ladakh, and I did have a character, a woman, in my head. So I knew I wanted to set the novel in the 1950s. I decided Ladakh was not open in 1940s, 1950s, 1960s to tourists at all. So I felt that would be quite interesting to set a novel in the 1950s. And I had Patricia in my head, who came from a very sad family where something had happened a few years before she was born that very much affected the lives of her parents and obviously seeped through into her life. So Patricia was in my head. And I think a lot of people probably have characters in their head that are waiting to come out. So I started researching Ladakh. It's a province, an Indian province, and I didn't know what my main storyline, what my plot would be, until when I was researching the life, the social organization of the people who lived in the villages in Ladakh, I came upon the fact that because there is so little rain, it's a very high mountain plateau north of the Himalayas and west of Tibet, with so little rain, the social organization of the family reflected the difficulty of feeding too many people in the one house. And they had a way of organizing themselves that affected not the first three sons in the family, but the fourth son. The minute I found that, I had my story, my plot for Kaldam. Today, you could not do the journey my uncle did because it is kidnap country. Very, very dangerous, Jammu Kashmir. But my uncle had described it in detail, and I was able to send my character, Patricia, and her father actually go to Ladakh, and they were able to follow my uncle's route. So if people read the book, they could do the journey in safety, in bed, or in the bedside chair, a journey that they really could not do today. But I focused the story actually in the Buddhist part. I thought the way they lived was absolutely fascinating. Illustration of finding a background of something you're interested in and bringing a story out of it. Historical novel or a novel set at a different time, a different place. I think it is completely pointless to pick up a fully formed story and plonk it there.
Yeah,
the background and what goes on at the time and the way people live should be organic in the novel.
Yeah, that's very good advice, I think.
I do think it should be. Otherwise, what is the point? You might just as well set the novel in the present day. Why go to the trouble of looking at a background if you're not going to use what you find?
And when you have your plot in place or in your mind, do you stick with it or are you flexible within that?
I would say everybody, I would think, is probably, as I am, one likes to think one is the norm. You do have an idea. you form this idea gradually, but within it you're flexible. And the best way to describe it, I have described it this way before, is that you are starting from a train station and you know where the terminal will be, you know your destination. You know, as you're gradually researching the book, you find one or two things of particular interest and you know you will use those in your story. So you know the key stations. Mm-hmm. What you don't know is how you're going to get to the different stations. When people talk about story and plot, the difference is the story is just the straightforward journey. The plot is actually how you get there.
Good analogy, yeah.
I think it would be very difficult to begin a book and not know where you're going. If you think about the first three chapters, I always say, I mean, I don't draw lines to say, right, three chapters, that's act one, a great chunk in the middle, that's act two, two or three chapters, that's act three. I don't in my head do that, and I don't do that in a written plan, but somewhere in my back I do feel that you have your beginning, your first three chapters, and you have to introduce. You have to introduce your background, you have to introduce the genre so the reader knows what sort of book they're reading and the tone of it. Is it scary? Is it exciting? Is it romantic? You have to introduce the characters. You have to have some kind of inciting incident, yeah, so that the reader knows that something's happening, and you have to suggest where it's going. All that you do it in the first three chapters. So if you do not know where you're going, I think it would be very hard to lead the reader there. And while I do understand that some people just sit down and write, I believe they would have to go back and add an awful lot in and structure it a lot and play around with it as if it's plasticine to make it fit what they do eventually come up with. It's a little bit easier to know where you're going when you start. I've always found it like that. And if you've got that clear in your head, you know how you're going to resolve it. Not necessarily the ending, which will be the final page or two pages, but the resolution. I like logic. I would find it very difficult to start without any idea of my destination. But I think until you start writing your novel, you do not truly know your character. Even if, as some people say, they write about three pages about their character that they know they might eventually take out, somehow or other, in the back of your mind, you know that you're only writing that to get to know your character. There is a little line between you and what you're writing, a slight distancing. But when you're actually in the novel and you're writing and you're starting to think, now how would my character respond, you understand so much more about your characters than you ever did at the beginning. That means you have to look at the way something that is going to come in their path, maybe, how will they react? Because after all, the story is going to be cause and effect. A proper story grows organically out of the things that happen to the characters and their responses. You cannot possibly know, I think, at the beginning, everything that will happen, and you will get ideas, because the more you know your characters, the more it will give you ideas of things they might have done. And then I'm flexible enough, obviously, to be able to put that in, go back and put it in, unless it was an omission. I realised as I came towards the end I'd left something out, then of course I could go back and put it in.
Listening to you, I feel quite inspired to go and start again.
That's brilliant. That's
great advice. Thank you.
Any tips for anyone approaching a novel for the first time? So any tips in addition to what you've already said?
For writing a novel?
Yes.
Yes, I would say, because if you're starting, you will get a lot of advice, and everybody gives advice. It is subjective. It's what works for one person. They will say, this is the way to do it. And a lot of people will be told, sit down and just write. Keep on writing. Never go back. Just carry on writing until you get to the end. I could never do that, and I think it is fraught with potential problems. Because, first of all, if you get to the end and you realise you've missed the crucial bit, then are you going to ignore it, or are you going to go back and put it in? And it will have an effect on the character responses, and it will affect the whole of the book. By the end of your novel, you probably have written 90 or 95,000 words. That is a phenomenal number of words if you've got to go back and adjust. It is, I think, very much easier to be determined the path you're starting out on and to start writing the novel. And if you keep getting ideas for things that would happen, you will always have a notebook next to you. A writer always has a notebook next to the bed, along with the bedside table book, and in the bag, in your pocket, and just jot down. You do not have to put all your ideas into excellent prose, but you jot down the ideas of the things that you think will happen. So you have a way forward, but that you concentrate on what you're actually writing, and that you do try to get it more than just the meanderings coming out of your mind, but something that is a little bit more structured. And when I finish writing for the day, the first thing I do the next day is something a lot of people are told never to do, but for me it works. I go back over what I wrote the day before. I do this because, first of all, I'm nuts about crosswords, and I have learned that you can be studying cryptic crosswords the night before and you cannot find the answer to something. So you put it down, you go back to it the next morning, you pick it up, and you can see the answer. It's staring you in the face.
Yeah.
So if the first thing you do is you go through what you wrote the day before, normally I wouldn't expect to do more than 2,000, 2,500 decent words, but I would. If you go through that, you will automatically find yourself, I don't even want to use the word edit, you will be tightening things up, making it a little bit better, and that's a very good feeling from which to start writing the next stage of the novel. But also, in addition to the fact that you're in the style, you're aware of what you've just written, so you're less likely to repeat yourself, you are also back in the world in which you've set the novel, in your fictional world, and you are also in the heads of your characters, because you've just read about 2,000 words of what they're doing. When you start writing again, I believe your writing will be better, and it will have more meaning, because it's informed by what's gone on before. And I think perhaps going at that sort of pace, I would find much easier to work from than writing the whole thing and then thinking, oh my goodness, look what I've got, what on earth am I going to do with it now? And the other thing, another piece of advice I would give, out of experience, I didn't do this with my first novel. With The Road Back, I did research it thoroughly, and I had a folder on my computer called The Road Back, and I also had a research document. The clothes they wore, because that affects the way you walk. The ground they walked on, the terrain, because that affects what's under your feet. The work, the sort of things they were doing the day, the flora and fauna, the weather, the climate, everything, all in one document. Well, when it got to the final editing stage, and I needed to find a particular place so that I could put something in or wanted to use it, I had a huge research document to scroll through. So when I wrote the next book, A Bargain Struck, I had my folder, A Bargain Struck. I had photos I took when I went to Wyoming in the folder, but I also had a file for weather, a file for work, a file for clothes. And when I was writing something, or food, I was doing a meal, I would just minimize that file, which would be at the bottom of my computer screen, much, much easier. So that was one of the things I learned, that it's really important to keep your material in a safe place. One of the reasons is I do sometimes travel, and I like to be able to work, but I'm not necessarily on the internet. So I like to have all the files, everything I might need, actually on hard drive, so I'm completely independent of the internet. My other last little piece of tip, when I have done a chapter, I have a file, a sheet, as many pages as necessary, divided up so that I have, first of all, the first column is chapter one, the second column is page number, the page it begins, the third column is the dates and ages, where it's set and how old the people are. The next column is content, just briefly, then word count, because I like to keep an eye on the chapter length, and finally, notes. In the note column, for example, I have a problem with the word dryly. I can never remember which is it D-R-Y-L-Y or D-R-I-L-Y in England or America. So the first time I use that word, I put it in notes. And then when I'm going to use it again, because this little bell says, right, how did you spell it? I've got it in note.
That is a really good tip.
But I do that at the end of every single chapter. I don't wait and go back through it at the end. So I build it up as I go. And if I alter something, like I change the order of two chapters in the saga I've just written, I then adjust it on my plan, because it is an essential record.
It's all really, really, really helpful. So what are you currently working on, Liz, and when can we expect to be able to read it?
I hope it won't be too long before Darjeeling Inheritance hits the shelves. It's set in Darjeeling, as the title suggests. I had wanted to go there in October, but there were troubles there, and that's why we had to change plans and go and find tea plantations elsewhere, which was in Kerala. But it's set in 1930 during the Raj, and it's the story of three tea plantations, in effect. And I absolutely loved writing it.
Okay, that's lovely. Thank you very much. Yes, no, it's been fabulous. Absolutely brilliant. We love it.
Thank you so much for inviting me to talk to you today.
Our pleasure. It's been a delight. Thank you.
Well, I'm definitely going to build myself a spreadsheet and put my chapter by chapter.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I've done it constantly, and I always kind of restart it when I move things around. And it just occurred to me, if you had one page for each chapter rather than a spreadsheet, you could, and you swap the chapters around, you just move the page around.
Or cards. You could do it on cards, couldn't you? Yeah. Whatever works for you, really. But keeping track of the ages is really important.
Yeah.
Instead of having to scroll back hundreds of pages.
Well, I found one incident in my edit where somebody had died before... that Grace was remembering that they died before they died.
Oh dear.
Whoops, just died.
Well, I think I need to do something like this. I have started a spreadsheet, but I haven't got enough ideas to put in it yet. But as an idea for a scene occurs, I am putting it in, because, of course, I'm going from prehistoric through to the future, so I've really got to get a grip on time.
Oh, that's human history, yeah.
A lot of mine is kind of reminiscence. Yes. Mm-hmm. So she's in the today, but she's recalling events from 30 years ago. So that's why I find it quite difficult to keep track.
With the village called Far Away, some of the people are elderly, but some of the incidents which are still impacting on their life maybe happened when they were teenagers, so that's also quite difficult, you know, to get that sort of setting in the Civil War and things right.
Yeah, one of the things I've been dealing with for the past few weeks is not because I'm writing in scenes as they occur to me and not in a real linear fashion. Mm-hmm. I was going through, wait a minute, does this go before that? And so I really need to have some, or now that I have enough scenes, I need to take time to put them in some sort of order, and then I'll see the gaps.
Yeah.
But I don't know how a spreadsheet would work for that, because I don't know how.
Well, I think you'd have a timeline spreadsheet, wouldn't you? From, you know,
or just a table in a word processor document, just a table.
Depends how visual you are. I'm a visual person, so I need to see it laid out, you know, as a picture.
And I learn lots of people that use Post-it notes or cards on.
I was thinking perhaps when you mentioned before, index cards might work better for you.
Well, that's whatever works for you. And I think, that's what Liz was saying. She doesn't have a particular method of plotting, but she has to plot. She has to know more or less where she's going. Yeah. So, you know, it's whatever works for you. Everybody is different.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got the broad outline, but my plot involves a few timelines. You know, there's the aliens leader, and then there's the Brienne. There's about three storylines going on. So I think it's really important that I listen to this again and really take on some of these plotting ideas, because that's the bit that daunts me, actually. And every time I feel daunted, I don't write.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Liz has made some very good suggestions, I think, and it was an interesting interview.
Very
interesting. I thought the fact that she goes to bed with her cryptic crossword clue in her head and wakes up with the answer is exactly what you do, Linda.
Exactly. Isn't it? Yeah.
That's what you do. You go to bed with a problem for Mary Magdalene and wake up in the morning with it solved. So I'm going to start going to bed with problems now. Instead of a book and a glass of wine, I'm going to bed with a problem.
Some of mine. So if you've got any tips about plotting or any special techniques you use, do let us know on the Facebook group.
Yes, any hints gratefully.
Yes, we'd love to hear from you. Nicola, you've been playing around with the snowflake method, haven't you?
When I first had the idea for the book, it seemed like such a daunting task, and my method of working in my day job, if you like, is to break big tasks down into simple structures. So I went looking to see if there was a simple structure beyond the three-act structure, which you guys had already shared with me, about how to actually put a book together. And I came across the snowflake method, which I have found very helpful. And Steph very kindly sent me a breakdown of it, which I think I can explain to you quite quickly. So step one, you write a one-sentence synopsis of your story, which was quite easy because I had the idea. Mm-hmm. Step two, expand your synopsis to a full paragraph, which I, again, was quite easy. Step three, create a summary sheet for each major character. Now, I tend to do this away from the computer, so I'll sit and think about the characters, and then I'll sit and just write down a bit of background about them. And it gives you the structure for what you should include in that background, which I found very helpful. Then expand your one paragraph synopsis to multiple paragraphs, which again is not difficult to do. Then you write one page retelling the story from each character's point of view.
And that's interesting.
Yeah, that was really interesting. And I tell you what that did, that helped me flesh out some of my other characters who were a bit, I knew who, you know, I had the archetypes, if you like, but I didn't know how to flesh them out. And that really helped to give them background motivation and it got you to think about their values and their goal, their personal goals as well, which was really helpful. So now when you're writing about how they interact with each other, it's much easier because you know where they're coming from. And then it says expand each paragraph from your main synopsis to a full page. So if you had, I know you just had to do this, how many paragraphs were in the synopsis generally? They range from what?
Well, they range from one page, 500 words, to six. The Lucy Cavendish Fiction Prize this year wanted between 6 and 10 pages.
Wow.
Synopsis.
Wow. Amazing.
That's quite a long
synopsis. It's a long one, yeah.
And then you're going back to expand your character sheets as much as you can, because obviously, you know, and then you've got them, so every new idea you can just add in. And then step 8 is to develop a list or spreadsheet of all the scenes needed to tell your story. So that's proving very helpful. And then you write a description of each scene, and then you use all of the above to write the first draft of your novel. So you do all this before you even start writing.
Yeah.
But I found that the ideas started coming so quickly that I had to capture them.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I only got halfway through this before I started writing. Yeah. But the point of this is that he's a computer programmer originally, and he's had lots of very successful books as well.
Mm-hmm.
But he says the reason you do this first is because as you're going through each of these steps, you know everything changes and evolves, and it's better that it changes and evolves before you start writing than when you've actually got, you know, a 70,000 word novel and you have to go back and look for all the incidences that have been,
which is what Liz was talking
about, which would be changed by a change in character motivation or backplot, for example.
Right.
So, you know, I actually think it's pretty good, and it definitely worked me up to the point where I couldn't help but start writing.
And what's the name of the originator?
I knew you were going to ask that. I can't remember.
Well, we will find it and we will put it on the Facebook page or the links. Okay, lovely. Thank you. And Stephanie, you were going to talk about the 3-act structure.
Yes, well, I find this quite useful when starting out. And the 3-act structure, basically, and it's I suppose it probably comes from screenplay to start with, but... Mm-hmm. Again, Liz talked about it, you know, the first 3 or 4 chapters are Act 1, then you've got a big chunk in the middle, which is Act 2, and then a few chapters at the end is Act 3. But within those acts, so during Act 1, you introduce your character's environment, you create ambiguities, conflict, tension, and then there has to be a turning point at the end of Act 1. It's what Liz referred to as the inciting incident. So it's a twist which shifts the boundaries, which says, you know, we're now moving from normal to, you know, something difficult. Now, if you think about Hellinglei, my book, there's a number of places where Act 1 could end. It could end when Grace is taken off to the hospital, but I chose that my turning point was when she's actually committed. So, which actually happens, curiously enough, at the end of chapter 3.
Right.
So she's committed indefinitely. But I have to say that was more by accident than design. And then Act 2, you build your characters and environments. You show characters behaving differently in varied situations. You build on your inciting incident. So you build on the twist. And then all of that builds to a moment of crisis. And by this point in the stories, the readers are going to be clear about what the issues of the story are, what the moral of the journey, what the moral of the story is, what journey the protagonist is on, what values are being examined and tested and so on, which I shan't tell you about Hellinglei.
No, you want to read it.
And then Act 3 is your resolution or denouement, what have you. Now, this often happens, the resolution is often not just one resolution. It's often a kind of spiralling crisis, which builds into a big crescendo. But things aren't what they seem, And finally, the resolution comes when main character reaches their moral choice. Mm-hmm. So it's important in Act Three to know what the moral choice of your main character is. And then at the end, you're looking at what the character's learned, what journey they've been on, how the character's changed. So if you take that very simple three-act structure, and we can post links to this on, it's all over Google, I mean, just put in three-act structure and this will come up.
Yeah.
I found that a really good starting point to make sure that I'd got all the elements of the story.
Yeah, together. I mean, what I would like to ask is there a danger of becoming too formulaic?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And I didn't do the three-act structure until later.
Yeah.
And that's when I was working on a synopsis.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at how to write a synopsis. And actually, that's one way to write a synopsis.
Yeah.
Is to take your three-act structure.
Right.
And see how your story fits. Mm-hmm. But it's known as a plotting tool.
Mm-hmm.
But I found it very useful after I've written it. And actually, it did make me think, well, what is the inciting incident? Is it when she's taken away from her family? Or is it when she's actually told she's got to stay in hospital indefinitely? Mm-hmm. Or is it something that happens later in the story? You know, what is the incident?
Yeah.
And I decided that when she's taken away from her family, she's only on the observation for 7 days. So she still believes she's getting out.
Mm-hmm.
So although the tension is building and the conflict is building, until she's actually told, you have been diagnosed as schizophrenic, you're staying here till I, the doctor, say you're well enough to leave.
Mm.
That for me was the inciting incident in my novel.
Yeah.
But you can see it. You could interpret it in different places. Yeah. But once I knew that was the inciting incident, then I had to make sure that everything that happened before that built the tension.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
So that she had to be thinking about her children, she had to be getting upset, you know, wondering what they're doing, remembering them, and so on.
And this does work very well with the snowflake method as well, because if you go to your spreadsheet where you're listing your scenes, you can then colour code a batch of scenes, as in, you know, first act, the batch of scenes, first half of the second act, second half of the second act, third act, and you can put the little summary of what should happen in each of the acts, so that as you're looking at your scenes, you can see where they need to go, which helped a lot.
Yeah. Mm. It's about taking the tools and personalising them to a certain extent, making them work for you, but not as a substitute for creativity and ideas.
Absolutely
or,
not.
You know,
absolutely not. No.
Well, I always think of systems like this as a structure to build your creativity on. And, and I think perhaps great writers have known how to craft a good story. They must have had some innate sense of this three-act structure without even knowing what it was.
Yeah.
You know, but now we've got the tools, so why not use them?
Okay, great.
I think it's like, I don't know, a dressmaker.
Yes.
You know, you get a fabulous idea for an outfit or a dress, but you still need a pattern.
Yeah.
And a body shape and darts and seams and things.
Yeah, good analogy.
It's a good analogy, yeah.
And then along comes Comte des Garçons and Jean Galliano, and they take all the seams and put them into different places, but they had to know where they should
have been. You have to know the rules in order to break
structure. You do. Okay. Great. Well, if you've got any tips on plotting, do let us know on the Facebook group. We'd be very interested to find out.
I certainly would.
Mm. Yes, please. It's nearly time to wrap up for this week, but before we do, there's just time for Stephanie and Chris Heath to tell us what they're reading at the moment. So, Steph, what's on your bedside table?
Well, this is a book that Heather gave me. It's called Half a Yellow Sun, and it's by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
I love her writing.
It was actually written some years ago, but it won the Orange Broadband Prize. It's a account of love, violence and betrayal. It's basically set in...
is it Nigeria?
Yes, yeah, it's Nigeria, Biafra. It's about Biafra's struggle to establish an independent republic in southeastern Nigeria during the late 1960s.
Mm.
Now, I remember as a child being told to eat up because there were starving children in Biafra. And a few months ago, as part of a book club, I read a book called An Inconvenient Marriage, which covered the marriage of Seretse Khama to an English woman, Ruth, and how... At the time, his country was called something else, which the name of which escapes me, but it's now Botswana.
Mm-hmm.
And I realised, Betuana, then you're absolutely right. And I, when I read that, I realised how little I know about African history.
Yeah.
So when Heather offered me this book, because I was looking for something to read, I jumped at it because this is another part of recent African history, you know, in the last century. I'm looking forward to reading it. And I've seen a TED talk that the author did recently about her, you know, her upbringing and and her motivation for writing, and I thought she was stunning.
She is. She's stunning. Wonderful to listen to. I've seen her interviewed on TV, and she's a wonderful writer. The one that I have is called Purple Hibiscus, and that's a great book. And you'd like that because it's about being brought up with the father who's a preacher. Linda.
Purple Hibiscus.
Yeah, yeah.
What country is?
It's set in Nigeria, but the father is a preacher. So it's obviously a very different context.
Yeah.
Mm. But I thought you'd be interested in it. Yeah, she's a wonderful writer.
No, I'm really looking forward to
reading
it.
I'll look and see if I've got it on my bookshelf.
I certainly found I felt quite ashamed of myself that I didn't know about a lot of the things that were in that. Mm-hmm. I thought I should have known this. I should have remembered this. I thought it was fantastic. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I have a friend who's Cameroonian. He worked with my husband, and Mike said he used to get very upset at people sort of talking about Africans.
Yes. As if it's place.
You know, just one kind of African.
It's huge, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's
massive. You know, they are. It's a... Well, it's like Europe, you know, you wouldn't compare the average German or stereotypical German or Austrian with, you know, somebody Italian. And it's the same. You get that same diversity in Africa.
Yeah, true.
And I'm very undereducated about Africa and the history of Africa. So.
Well, we all are in the sense that our education was... was almost from the British colonial point
of
view.
Empire.
And certainly, you know, my upbringing as an army brat was very much in that colonial tradition. Mm. So,
well, we've got this for our book club, so and my children are quarter Nigerian, so that'll be an education for me. I'll be able to tell them some stuff.
Yeah,
not that they'll ever read a book, I don't think, but they might listen, they might listen to it, you never know.
Yeah. Okay, so let's hear what's on Chris Heath's bedside table.
So Chris Heath, author of The World According to Grandpa series of children's picture books, what's on your bedside table?
Well, on my bedside table, it's kind of a cheat, really. I am rereading my favourite book, which is Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It's my absolute go-to book of joy. It was written in the 60s by a real kind of icon of the counterculture movement and the Summer of Love, Ken Kesey, who also did the electric Kool-Aid acid test. Obviously, there's the Jack Nicholson film that it's based on, and that's where I started, and I worked my way backwards to the book itself. And what I love so much about it is that it's raucous and revolutionary and all of those things and violent, but it's also full of joy and warmth, and it has a really big heart. And I think that's the key to any book for me. It has to have a heart. And this book has it, you know, a mile wide. It's about a criminal called Randall Patrick McMurphy, who was transferred out of regular prison to a mental asylum. And the suspicion throughout the book is he faking just to get out of prison? Or is he really mentally ill like he claims? And he's trying to get the soft option. And what I love about the book as opposed to the film is it's told in the first person from a character called Chief Bromden, who's a Native American patient at the facility. And I'm going to read a small section now. Like the whole book, it's from the point of view of the chief, and it's when McMurphy first enters, when they first enters all of the patients' lives. I hear him coming down the hall, and he sounds big in the way he walks, and he sure don't slide. He's got iron on his heels, and he rings it on the floor like horseshoes. He shows up in the door and stops and hitches his thumbs in his pockets, boots wide apart, and stands there with the guys looking at him. Good morning, buddies. There's a paper Halloween bat hanging on a string above his head. He reaches up and flicks it so it spins around. Mighty nice fall day. He talks a little the way Papa used to, voice loud and full of hell, but he doesn't look like Papa. Papa was a full-blood Columbia Indian, a chief, and hard and shiny as a gunstock. This guy is red-headed, with long red sideburns and a tangle of curls out from under his cap. Been needing cut a long time, and he's broad as Papa was tall, broad across the jaw and shoulders and chest. A broad, white, devilish grin. And he's hard in a different kind of way from Papa. kind of the way a baseball is hard under the scuffed leather. A seam runs across his nose and one cheekbone where somebody laid him a good one in a fight, and the stitches are still in the seam. He stands there waiting, and when nobody makes a move to say anything to him, he commences to laugh. Nobody can tell exactly why he laughs. There's nothing funny going on, but it's not the way that public relations laughs. It's free and loud, and it comes out of his wide, grinning mouth and spreads in rings bigger and bigger till it's lapping against the walls all over the ward. Not like that fat public relation laugh. This sounds real. I realize all of a sudden it's the first laugh I've heard in years. And that's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, my bedside table read.
Didn't he read that beautifully?
Yes, yeah.
He has a wonderful voice.
He does.
That.
Well, you know, he's a podcaster as well as a children's author, and he does have a lovely voice for radio and very articulate.
Anyone else read the book? I've only ever seen the film, which was fantastic.
I read it.
When I saw the film, actually, a bit like Chris, I saw the film and then went back and read the book. Yeah. Yes, and it's wonderful.
I have read the book, but it was some years ago.
Me too.
But did you know that Kirk Douglas tried to make the film for years? It took him about a decade to get backing to get the film made.
Really?
And by the time he got it, he had to accept that he was too old to play the critical role, which, as we know, Jack Nicholson did so well.
Yeah.
You know, was absolutely brilliant in it. But that's just an interesting little anecdote.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't imagine Kirk Douglas in that role.
Well, you can't imagine anybody doing it now, but he wanted
to.
But I remember that. What I loved about reading the book was the chief's character really struck me in the film.
Yeah.
So when you read the book and it's all from the chief's point of view. It's a really great
It's an
way
interesting,
of
very interesting way of doing it.
Yeah. Great choice.
Yeah.
Great choice.
Okay. Yeah. Sadly, that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. Thanks for listening. But before we go, I get to announce our new competition. This time, we're asking for short stories of up to 2,000 words. So the theme this time is On the Way, and the closing date is May 31st. The details and terms and conditions will be posted on our Write Club the Podcast Facebook page. Tom Bromley, who we spoke to a few weeks ago about editing, will be our guest judge. The competition is free to enter, and there will be a fabulous prize of a lovely canvas Write Club the Podcast book bag, full of goodies, including books and stationery. Next week, we'll be talking about writing groups. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. And please take a few minutes to leave us a review. Goodbye!
Bye!